This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We take the convenience of mobile technology for granted, but really the only thing mobile about a smartphone is the handset. Every call, text, or Google search depends on a network of cell sites connected by miles and miles of fiber optic cable. Verizon's Mobile Switching Center, or Super Switch for Orlando, is a squat concrete building behind a chain-link fence. It's actually a building within a building, designed to withstand a Category 5 hurricane. And if a storm were to hit, there's an enormous generator, backup batteries, and a parking lot called the Farmyard, where mobile cell sites and generators are ready to go. In the heart of the building is the equipment room, lined with rows and rows of servers.
During 2004, I actually slept in, I was in South Florida then, but I actually slept in the equipment room just because I like that white noise and it was nice and cool in here. So as you can hear and see, right, there's a lot of equipment in here. There's a lot of, it's a little bit cooler in here. So this is one of the critical rooms that we, equipment rooms that we have. On this side of the room, all the white and blue cabinets, this is our legacy equipment. This is our legacy CDMA equipment or our 3G network. So this is getting phased out over time, right?
That's Chad Kuhn, Senior Manager for Network Assurance with Verizon Wireless.
This is a central location that processes basically all the voice and data calls for the greater Orlando metro area for Verizon Wireless.
How many calls are we talking about?
So we approximately process 7 million voice calls per day and approximately 500 million data sessions per day. What we call data has evolved tremendously over the last decade, even before we had 4G. Even on our 3G EVDO network, data that was really what we considered to be the data boom or the data explosion. About the same time that a lot of the internet apps and services were becoming widely used, and especially with the younger generation of millennials who were primarily on a device of some kind at all times. Data has exponentially increased in the last several years and continues to do that year over year. So if you think about your device, whether it be a smartphone or a tablet, anytime that you explore the internet, send a text message, all those are considered a data session. You're always connected to the network, but anytime you initiate a new session, that's what we basically call a data session. So we process about 500 million of those a day, about half a billion data sessions per day, which is tremendous.
Now, in the event of an emergency like a hurricane or some other kind of natural disaster, does that amount of data you're processing go up?
Usually it does, absolutely. I mean, any significant event, people get on their phones and like to communicate, especially through social media. So there's a large volume of data there that usually happens. And we've seen that even during the Pulse event and other crises. So it's not only during those kind of events, but it could even be a political rally or a sporting event or something along those lines. We always see an increase in data volume during events like that.
So right in the middle of hurricane season, it's a pretty active season according to forecasters. If there were a hurricane to hit central Florida, make landfall somewhere in Florida, you guys would be faced with a lot of calls, and then there's some environmental considerations to think about as well. What sort of pressure does that put on this building and the system as a whole?
We plan for those kind of scenarios. If you want to consider it always a buffer zone into how we engineer our network, we're always prepared for that. And we also have our portable equipment that we highlighted earlier, our portable cows, colts, cells on wheels, in case we need extra capacity at any particular location.
And you referred to it as the Farmyard. Just explain what that means for the listeners.
So the Farmyard is pretty much kind of like it sounds. Our portable equipment has acronyms. So a cow, for example, is a cell site on wheels. A colt is a cell site on a light truck. We also have a horse unit, which is a portable air conditioning unit on a trailer. So that's where the term farmyard comes from. In addition to that, we have emergency portable generators that we can deploy at an instant moment to restore power to an individual cell site or multiple cell sites. Or again, just to provide extra coverage in case, say, during a hurricane, we actually lose a tower or a cell site altogether, we can deploy a colt that has all the technologies on it, 3G, 4G, LTE, and deploy that to provide the coverage in that certain area. Our EOC, which is an emergency operations center, we actually activate that prior to the storm hitting, and then it goes into full activation once the storm leaves. The purpose of the EOC is to restore our network as fast as we can so that our entire network team gets involved at that point. Our cell technicians, field technicians, our system technicians here at this location. We actively go out and restore those cell sites. Most of the time it's a power situation, so we'll deploy one of our portable generators, or we'll work with a third-party vendor to restore the services, whatever we need to get restored.
Now, you were referring to this building. You have a bunch of acronyms to describe it, but it's also known as a super switch, right?
That's a common term that is used. And really all that refers to is because we can withstand Category 5 winds. This particular switch in Orlando and one of our sister switches in Pembroke Pines, they actually are a little bit different than the other three locations and really get that term super switch because of the amount of traffic that those two particular locations process.
So it's pretty important that these buildings stay up and running in a hurricane.
Absolutely. These are critical centers for not only day-to-day operations, but for emergency situations as well.
You talked about a building within a building. What does that mean?
Basically what that means is you can call it a buffer zone between the two buildings, but the interior of the building where all the critical equipment is actually completely separate and isolated from the exterior of the building with a buffer zone between the two. And that's just to add integrity to the building and our equipment rooms and protect it from any outside threats. So, for example, if someone so wanted to drive a truck into the building and hit the outside of the building, it would not get into the interior of the building where the critical equipment is.
And it's a pretty safe spot to be in a storm?
Probably the safest place to be during a storm. I've personally rode out several storms within the building. Prefer that over even my own house. We have, of course, we have emergency backup power, which keeps our refrigerators going. We can take showers here. We can do laundry here without ever losing power or having inconvenience to that. And the other important reason is it goes back to our customers. During restoration efforts in a hurricane, we want our network personnel to be on site and have everything they need to restore the network for our customers. So we don't want to give them inconveniences, having to worry about their homes or how to get to work or anything like that. So we'll even put our technicians and even some third-party vendors up in hotels to help facilitate that restoration effort.
Quite a lot's changed in the last decade or so since we had that big storm season back in 2004. Is it easier to get those networks up and running quicker now than it would have been back then?
It is, and if nothing else, we've had practice. Right, 2004 gave us a lot of practice. So not only did it identify some weaknesses in the network that we can improve upon, but it essentially gave us practice and be able to get our plans together and how we want to restore things.
And you were pointing out there's a mighty amount of cable that comes into this building, right? And it's coming from cell sites all around the greater metro Orlando area. Just remind me how many cell sites we're talking about.
We serve over 600 cell sites from this location, and that includes the greater Orlando metro area, Ocala, Gainesville, the Space Coast, up to Palm Coast and down to Treasure Coast. So it's a large geographic area that we serve, and we always think of a wireless network being wireless, but really the only aspect of a wireless network that's truly wireless is between the handset and that cell tower. Mm-hmm. You still need a physical cable that comes from the cell tower back to this facility in order to process those calls. So there is probably thousands of miles worth of fiber out there coming from the cell sites back to this facility, in addition to the internal fiber at this facility.
And then, people take the convenience of mobile technology for granted, right? But just to that point, like this building, you've got some fairly durable, tried and tested technology, like a ginormous diesel engine in case things go south and you have to power up the building.
Yeah, so again, a couple other measures that we take in Verizon to make our network reliable. So in case of a storm or even just during the summertime in Florida with the lightning storms and thunderstorms that we get on a daily basis, if we lose commercial power, our generators are designed to run the entire building without commercial power. So here at this location, we have two independent 1.5 kilowatt generators, each with its own 6,000-gallon diesel tank. One of those generators alone can run the facility with a full tank for approximately 1 week. And even if those generators fail, we have backups of that. We have a backup battery system that the entire facility can run up to about 8 to 10 hours just on battery power. If that fails, we can actually bring in a portable generator on a truck called a GOAT, go back to the farmyard, which is a generator on a truck. We have one of those in the state that we can deploy anywhere within the state within a few hours.
Talking about power, I mean, that seems to be one of the, if not the biggest, one of the biggest concerns you would have in a storm. So what about those cell sites? Like, how long can they go if there's a major power outage, and what can you do to keep them running?
A typical cell site will have a battery backup on site for that individual cell site, which usually will give it 4 to 6 hours worth of power. 91% of our cell sites in Florida have a permanent generator as well. So just the same as this facility, as this MSC facility, if commercial power is lost to a cell site, the on-site generator at the cell site will start automatically and keep that running. There's an on-site tank as well. Those range in size depending on the cell site and how much is there, but it usually will keep a cell site running for several days just with that backup generator. And if that fails, we have portable generators that we can deploy. And at moment's notice, we have approximately 20 portable generators just on site here at this location that we can just hook up to a truck just like you would a boat, and you pull it out to a cell site and hook it up. And it usually only takes 10 to 15 minutes to hook it up once you're on site.
Being able to make a call or a text or just connect with people on your mobile phone is pretty important now in an emergency, right? I mean, that's one of the key things. So what you do here is very important in emergency situations.
Absolutely. I think so. During an emergency situation, people are trying to get a hold of their families, and if nothing else, just to make sure they're okay. But there's obviously an increase in 911 calls. My philosophy with that is it's all about that one call. And this is part of our credo. It is truly about that one person being able to make that one 911 call when they need to. So it's super critical. So it's not just, you know, hey, how you doing? Are you okay? Is your house okay? It's about that guy or that woman or that child or that's stuck in their car in a 5-foot puddle that, you know, has no other way to communicate or get out other than using their cell phone. So it's extremely important, not only during hurricanes or disaster recoveries, but just on a day-to-day basis. And really, that's what we're here for.
Chad Coon, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in August 2017. Still to come, for some, making a new home in Central Florida means learning a new language. Gina Burko-Solomon and Claudia Cardoso from the Adult Literacy League join us for a conversation about learning English. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. One in five adults in Central Florida reads at or below fifth grade level. That's according to the Adult Literacy League, which is on a mission to change that. Many of the league's students are brand new arrivals to Florida, and English is not their first language. From the Education Desk this week, a conversation about learning English. Gina Burko-Solomon is the Chief Development Officer at the Adult Literacy League. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for this opportunity.
We're also joined by Claudia Cardoso. She was a student and she is now the receptionist with the Literacy League. Thank you so much for being here as well.
Thank you.
So I want to start with you, Gina. What are you looking for as far as the need for volunteers to help train folks?
We're always in need of volunteer tutors and volunteers who are willing to give maybe administrative time, clerical time to help us around the office. But for example, right now we have nearly 80 students on the waiting list waiting to be matched with one-to-one tutors. Mm-hmm. So we train volunteers. You don't have to be a teacher. Any profession, volunteers from any profession, to serve as one-to-one tutors for the students that we're serving. We teach adults to read, write, and speak English, and more than 80% of the students that we're serving right now are English language learning. So ESOL students coming from other countries around the world wanting to learn to speak English.
Why is there such a big waiting list right now?
It's always a balancing act. We almost never catch up. As soon as we match who's on the list, you know, word of mouth, we're present in all of the libraries in Orange, Osceola, and Seminole counties with ESOL classes. So the students learn about us and the services we provide, and they want a tutor too. And, mm-hmm. you know, when we match a tutor and a student, there is a relationship that grows and that builds and grows. And so the progress that happens in that one-to-one setting is so different from what happens in the classroom. So it's really special. And when our students learn about it, they want one as well.
So Claudia, what was your experience of getting tutored through the Adult Literacy League?
Has been a beautiful experience because first, it's a good team. The second, I have a big opportunity to meet the different people for different countries and with different history in her life. But they have one goal, to learn English.
And that was the situation you were in when you came to Florida how many years ago?
I have been here 3 years and a half.
So how much English did you have before you came here?
I have a little English here. In that time, I went to the library. I went to the adult literacy for different classes. I have the opportunity to have a tutor, and she taught me a different skill for improve my English. That is a good experience because later I helped her in the library for help different speak Spanish people. This is a good experience. I love it.
And what brought you to Florida, can I ask?
I decided for Florida for different reasons. In my country, we have a lot of problems.
And that country is Venezuela, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for new opportunities, different in my country. I feel like I have a beautiful opportunity. I improve my English. I have a beautiful job.
You must have had a pretty positive experience with the Literacy League, the fact that you are now the receptionist for the league, right?
Yeah, it's correct.
So, Gina, just kind of drilling down to some of the numbers, I guess Claudia isn't alone in the fact that she's moved here from Venezuela. As she points out, there's obviously a lot of unrest in Venezuela. There are quite a few people on the waiting list who have come from Venezuela and from other countries as well, mm-hmm. and they need help to improve their English.
They do. We've seen a tremendous influx of students from Venezuela, from Puerto Rico after last year's hurricanes, also from places like former Soviet countries. So
really?
Lots of Russian-speaking students. We have quite a few Russian-speaking students in rather large Russian-speaking community here in Central Florida. So I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Kyrgyzstan and myself a Russian speaker. And, you know, when it was the Soviet Union, you have all of the people who were just Soviet. They were Kyrgyz Soviets and Kazakh Soviets. And so now that all these countries are independent, there are challenges for and issues for the people who are remaining. They're not considered Russian. They're not considered Kazakh. So they're stateless people. And we're, you know, accepting 50,000 people in that visa lottery program every year, as long as that program lasts. And mm-hmm. so we see tremendous numbers of Russian speakers. Central Florida is, you know, we think of it in terms of just so many Spanish speakers coming here, but our waiting list is pretty diverse. You know, of the 80 students, 20 are from Venezuela, 15 are from Puerto Rico, 10 are from Korea, Colombia, Brazil, Dominican Republic, Haiti, Russia, Mexico, India, Lebanon, China. So really a mixed bag. But definitely the predominant number is coming right now from Venezuela and from Puerto Rico.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to Gina Burko-Solomon. She's the Chief Development Officer with the Adult Literacy League. We're also talking to Claudia Cardoso. She was a student with the Literacy League. She's now the receptionist for the league. And just talking about the need for volunteers. So Gina, when you talk about matching a volunteer tutor with one of the students, does it need to be somebody who, for example, knows how to speak Russian or knows Korean or is a Spanish language speaker who can help out the folks who want to learn English, or is there not a need for that at all?
Not at all. Our rule of thumb at the Adult Literacy League is no English, no tutor. So a student has to be able to be proficient enough to be able to do something like schedule a first meeting with their tutor over the telephone. So telephone's pretty tough. The student has to be at a certain level, and we assess them when they come in and request a tutor. So the student has to be able to communicate somewhat in English. In some cases, we bend the rules a little bit here and there. And in some cases, we have tutors, volunteers, who are interested in learning a second language.
So it's like a language exchange?
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of that happening. So that does happen as well. But absolutely no need to speak another language just to be proficient in English yourself. And have several students, actually, who have made tremendous improvement. And a lot of times it's just building confidence and practice. There's so much English in there. They've studied it their whole lives. They just haven't had to use it. So once the students become proficient and comfortable, lots of times they come back and want to tutor themselves. So in those cases, it's a great opportunity for us to be able to serve really low-level students with someone who does speak their language. We wouldn't have been able to provide a tutor normally because they're not able to communicate well enough in English. But in this case, Raul's back and he wants to give back and he is a native Spanish speaker, so we may be able to match a real low-level student with him.
Claudia, when you were being tutored in English through the Literacy League, were you also teaching your tutor a little bit of Spanish? Was there some of that sort of language interchange going on?
I would like to do. Mm-hmm. Yes, because I think it's part of the experience, you know. I'm improving my English every day, but there are most of people like I improve Spanish because there are people like from America, from Chinese, like speak Spanish.
It's a useful language to have here in Central Florida, right?
Yes. It's interesting because they are from Korea lady, and she told me, I would like to meeting with you because we can interchange. You learning in Spanish, yeah, I can learn Korean. I go, oh yes, okay, it's fun. But it's part of the culture now, the people. Mm-hmm. That is really, really interesting and exciting because the people is amazing, really friendly. This is a good opportunity for to help the people, and the people help me.
But English is quite a complicated language, right?
I know. It's for that reason. I continue to study every day for improve my English. Now I need to talk in English a lot, and sometimes in Spanish, most of people, what did you say? Mm-hmm. But did you say, you go, no, you need to speak English here. Like, please help me in Spanish. Okay, I want to try. When the people went to try to go to the different classes, 1 month later, the people speak English. I ask, how is your English? It's really good. This school is perfect for learning English, and now I speak. Mm-hmm. They are a beautiful lady from Morocco. She's so funny. She started 2 weeks ago. She no say, no hello, nothing. And her daughter told me she need basic classes. I go, okay, I have the basic classes for her. Yesterday was so happy because she told me, hey, lady, how are you?
That's what she said. Hey, lady.
Yes. Wow, I'm not proud of you because you speak English. I'm happy. I'm happy. But the most fun, she's in the small class. We interchange different languages, Spanish and English. And she stayed there. And she tried to speak Spanish and English.
So she's learning both.
Yes.
Gina, what are some of the other things that you tell folks if they're, you know, they're taking classes, but what are some of the other ways that, that folks are trying to improve their English?
Watching the news, especially in English, putting the subtitles on the in English, putting the subtitles on the screen can help. You know, maybe they didn't catch it the first time around, but they're able to read it. And sometimes reading it is easier than catching it, listening. Radio and music. Lots of our teachers in the classes finish their classes or end class with a little karaoke version of a Beatles song or something. But music and definitely television and news, news to get a more, you know, formal version. And then music really helped.
Gina Burko-Solomon, I was interested to hear Claudia talk about one of the students from Morocco and part of the reason she came to take classes because her daughter, this lady's daughter, said she needs to learn English. And oftentimes, somebody's kids might have better English than they do, right? Is that sort of generational gap, is that useful to, you know, to have somebody whose kids maybe speak English and they can sort of help push them along that path of learning as well?
Definitely. And a lot of times the children come in with the parents to help them translate. We have classes at several school campuses in Orange County. So we're teaching the parents of the kids who are enrolled in the schools, Weingart Elementary and Walker and Middle School. So the parents drop the students off. But at the very beginning, it's the kids who bring their parents in and translate. And we hear from the parents a lot that they hate having to rely on, you know, their 12-year-old to translate at the doctor's office. And it creates that kind of a strange dynamic within the family that they mm-hmm. don't necessarily want for their children, but they're left with no choice. So the motivation behind the students that we're serving is really inspirational to all of us in the office. But yeah, we definitely see that a lot. Mm-hmm. Lots of children, adult children and younger children accompanying their parents to help them every day, every single day.
So the library is also a crucial part of this mm-hmm. partnership, right? I mean, mm-hmm. libraries can be real hubs for folks moving to a new place. If they come to Central Florida, that is sometimes the place they go to get information. They kind of build a sense of community there. Just talk a little bit about the importance of the library as part of this process of learning English and becoming a part of the community.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, it's free. And so they can check out all the books once they realize that it's a free program and they can have so many resources for their children and for themselves. But the Adult Literacy League serves Orange, Osceola, and Seminole counties, and we have partnerships with all the library systems in each of the three counties. We offer ESOL classes at I think just about every branch of Orange County Library and Seminole and Osceola now as well, English and citizenship classes. So it's a collaborative relationship. They help us populate the classes and promote it. They offer the Adult Literacy League the space to hold the classes for free. So we're benefiting their patrons and they're helping us with a place to serve the students that we need to serve. So it's an absolutely vital partnership. We... for example, in Orange County, there's a fee to reserve tutoring space. So in order for our tutors to be able to use the tutoring space for free, the private rooms, the reservable rooms in the library system, we provide these classes, and it's a wash for mm-hmm. us. We're serving their patrons, and then our volunteers don't have to pay. They get free space to work one-on-one with the students.
So just back to the need you have at the moment for tutors, mm-hmm. There is a bit of a demand there. What if somebody is thinking about volunteering, mm-hmm. what is the time commitment? What are they going to be expected to do?
Absolutely. Well, there's a brief online orientation to kind of tells you about what a typical student might look like, what a typical tutoring session might look like. And that's they can find that on our website, which is adultliteracyleague.org. And then there's an in-person training. It's about 3.5, 4 hours. An in-person training happens multiple times throughout the month, every month, sometimes in the evening, sometimes on the weekends, just to make it convenient. And then as soon as training is finished, you're matched based on geographics and time. So you know, for example, on your form, you fill out that you've got evenings available and you live in East Orlando. So we're going to try to match you with someone who can meet in East Orlando in the evening. And we ask our tutors and our volunteer and our students, for a 1 hour commitment to meet their student 1 hour. There's going to be some prep beforehand, before a session, a couple minutes or a half hour or so. So we ask for an hour. If they can give more, even better. But that's what we ask for. And for a year time commitment. And we ask for our students as well, because it takes time to build that relationship and progress really starts to happen after that.
Claudia Cardoso, what would you say to somebody thinking about getting some tutoring in English, what would you say to recommend the Adult Literacy League?
I recommend for everybody the Adult Literacy League. First, because it's friendly team. It's like your home, okay? And I think the people learn English and they improve different skills.
And it's not just English, right? I mean, you might pick up a little bit of Spanish or some other language along the way, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the point, yeah.
Well, Claudia Cardoso is a former student with the Adult Literacy League. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
And we're also joined by Gina Burko-Solomon. She's the Chief Development Officer with the Adult Literacy League. Thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, we go back before the smartphone era 26 years ago when Hurricane Andrew rolled ashore and Floridians huddled around their radios and portable televisions to monitor the progress of the storm. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. 26 years ago, when Hurricane Andrew made landfall, meteorologist Brian Norcross was on the air for 23 hours, keeping Floridians informed as the powerful storm wreaked havoc on South Florida. Norcross's book about the experience is called My Hurricane Andrew Story. Norcross's book about the experience is called My Hurricane Andrew Story, the story behind the preparation, the terror, the resilience, and the renowned TV coverage of the Great Hurricane of 1992. He spoke to Intersection's Brendan Byrne about the Category 5 storm and about hurricane preparation today.
I knew that some part of Southeast Florida was going to have a tremendous storm. But in my imagination, and all the time that I had studied hurricanes that had hit Miami and South Florida over the decades, and they were frequent from the beginning of the 20th century up through the 60s, hurricanes just came along like clockwork, seemed like big ones every few years. But nowhere in my mind or anybody that I knew's mind did we imagine what would happen even after we became aware that it was going to be an extreme storm, essentially a worst-case storm.
And what was that moment like for you, knowing that it's your job to inform people on this devastating storm? What's the weight of that responsibility on someone in a position like yours?
Well, it came in a couple of stages. One is I just thought, okay, we've got to really concentrate here one step at a time. We've got a good plan. We'd spent 2.5 years at WTVJ, the NBC station in Miami, planning for a hurricane. And then here was this significant storm at that point in our minds coming. And everybody was on full alert, working flat out. But then in the few hours, 3 or 4 hours before it actually hit, I could see not only was it going to be a very strong storm, but it was going to be one of those epic storms that we've never really seen in modern times. And at that point, I was racking my brain to try and think, what can I say beyond all of the things that we've talked about for hours and hours and hours continuously for 2 days of solid talking about how to prepare? What else could we do for people that were in their homes? I could see that it wasn't coming to downtown. It was coming to suburban Miami, Kendall, Homestead, down at Cutler Ridge in the southern part of Miami-Dade County. And those are almost all residential areas there. And so I'm thinking, what could they do? So I came up with this idea. I reminded myself of a book I had read about a family in Coral Gables that went through the great Miami hurricane of 1926. And as the wind was whistling through the house and they were hiding under the dining room table, they went to the laundry room first, and this guy put his kids in these big laundry tubs and covered the laundry tubs with a mattress, and he and his wife went to the garage and got in their old car. Well, back then, cars were built like, you know, steel cages, so it wasn't the worst thing in 1926. Well, that mattress came back to me, and I said, friends, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get a mattress off the bed and get ready. When the time comes, you get to your safe place in the hallway and the closet and the bathroom, you get under that mattress and we'll ride this out. And I've heard from hundreds or thousands of people that did that, and they all came out well, but many of them moved the mattress at the end of it and saw the sky because the house came apart around them.
So the mattress was to protect them from that falling debris from their roof, right?
Right, from the roof. Unfortunately, we had 15 people actually died in Miami during the event, and including a couple of people that died because wood came through the concrete block and impaled them. So this was an extraordinary event. Things that we saw happen that we really only had, you know, heard rumors about happening, about flying wood getting embedded into a concrete curb, like a stick going right into a concrete curb, or 2x4s coming through the concrete wall into the house, or plywood splitting palm trees, or 2x4s splitting palm trees. I have a picture right down the hall here of that they sent me after the storm of a 2x4 that was impaled in a palm tree about 30 feet up. Just an incredible picture. So these unbelievable things happened, and you know, the mattress was enough to keep people safe if they got in a closet or a hallway.
And that's a testament to being prepared for a storm, right? You're not able to do that in the moment. You need to be able to have that safe spot in your house ready to go. And God forbid it's going to get so bad that you need that mattress or something to protect you. You need to know where it is and where your family is, right?
Yeah, and what you're going to do. This is really something that everybody in Florida needs to do, is to think out where they're going to be for the storm. And if it gets to be a really bad storm, you know, where is the safe spot in their house? And in almost all houses, including in Central Florida, the safest spot is in some interior closet or interior hallway under a mattress. And that mattress getting added to it really came about because of Hurricane Andrew. And that thought that came from the 1926 story, but it does add that level of protection for hellacious storms when you really don't know what's going to happen to your roof, your walls, your windows, and other things that can fail, that you just don't want to be, you know, exposed to that failure. And the mattress is the handiest good protection you have in most houses.
Now, what role does media play during these storms? So you're a TV guy. I'm here on radio. They have two separate jobs, but how can these two mediums kind of work together during a storm?
Well, before Andrew was Hugo, if you remember, 3 years before Andrew was Hurricane Hugo in 1989, and I went up to Charleston after Hugo. Luckily, it didn't hit the city terribly. It was like a Category 2 in the city, but it destroyed the smaller towns to the north of Charleston. Well, all of the media went off the air in Hugo. They signed off, and they did that because their studios were in evacuation zones right near the water. The only thing that stayed on the air was one suburban AM daytime station, and they kind of did their best, but you know, they weren't really equipped to provide information. So it was really a terrible thing. And I said, well, okay, that can't happen, you know, in anything I'm involved with. So I went out looking for a radio station in South Florida to have a partnership with, and I made a deal with a station which, if you know South Florida, Y100 is a big FM station, popular station at the time. And I made the deal there, and I walk out of the studio, and I look, and I go, wow, this studio is right by the water here in Fort Lauderdale, right on Sunrise Boulevard, right near the Intercoastal. And I said, this is no good because they're going to get evacuated. So instead of running a dedicated line to their studio, I ran a dedicated line to their transmitter and then another line to their studio. And sure enough, the day before the hurricane, their engineer connected that dedicated line directly into their radio transmitter, and that's how we were on the radio through the storm. So the combination of television's news-gathering ability but radio's distribution is really the only way we have in the modern world to really serve the public the best that we can. And not that it's ideal, but it is the best we can. And we have to be sure that the connections between the TV stations and the radio stations, or whatever the news gathering entity is, and the radio stations is secure, because, you know, all of us have technical systems that are subject to fail if we don't have backups. And, you know, we were very fortunate. We put in a lot of backups in Miami in 1992, and we ended up using every one of them. But also, let me hasten to add that, you know, back then, every family and most people had a transistor radio, just a portable radio that ran on batteries, you know? And these don't exist in our society so much anymore.
But now everyone has a cell phone, right? Are you leveraging that technology now?
Well, you know, yeah, and as long as the cell phone works. So what happens to the cell phone systems is you know, you call that a non-robust communication system, as opposed to a portable radio, which is a very robust communication system. Nothing in your, you know, your house can fall down and your radio is still going to work. You can have tremendous damage in your neighborhood and the radio station that's broadcasting from 20 miles away is still going to work for you. But cell towers are vulnerable. And in every disaster, the ability to call on the cell phone is eliminated. In every disaster that comes along, you can't call because cell systems only will work for about 5%, maybe 10% of the people calling at any one time. And of course, when a disaster is going on, everybody wants to call. So you're reduced to reduced bandwidth, you know, kind of a wounded system. Maybe you can text, but that's not the equivalent at all of being able to have continuous information. And the radio in the middle of a hurricane really is it. In these days, modern days, we don't even have portable televisions. You know, back in 1992, a lot of people watched this on little black and white battery-operated televisions. But while they were under their mattress, I heard all kinds of stories. We don't even have that anymore.
We had a portable television in that closet during Andrew that we were watching the news on. I remember that vividly.
Yeah, but that technology doesn't exist anymore. Now it's coming. It's coming to, you know, mobile phones. But the problem with mobile phones is that you have to have really, you know, even when that happens, when we get to the stage where your phone can be like a TV that receives a signal from the TV station or off the air in some fashion, your phone you know, runs out of batteries quickly, and it's not easy to, you can't change the battery, so you have to have various ways of charging the batteries with no power. And so it's just not anywhere near as robust. And you can't imagine the phone replacing the radio, where after the storm, people would sit the radio on the counter and just keep up with what was going on while the whole family was trying to recover from the hurricane. You just don't have that ability with our modern technology and the fact that most people don't have radios.
And that again makes the case for preparation and early communication, which is something that you've been outspoken about. You argue that the National Hurricane Center should speak out about a coming storm sooner. I mean, aside from just the basic preparation, why do you think the National Hurricane Center needs to bring this information to the public sooner?
Well, this doesn't apply. This thought that I have doesn't apply so much to the Andrew situation, because Andrew happened really quickly. You know, it only developed into a hurricane 2 days before it hit as a Category 5, literally 48 hours. So it was a very compressed time window. We need to be ready for those super quick developing storms too. But the normal way that hurricanes develop today, it's over a period of a number of days, and we see the cone, and, you know, here comes the cone, and eventually the cone gets to the state, and, you know, we're looking at it for a week or 10 days. And the problem is that everyone in our society today is subject to information coming from all directions and all these different opinions. Some are informed opinions, some are not informed opinions. And what I think the National Hurricane Center should do is get out ahead of it. They tend to be on their schedule where they pick up the information and really become a part of the conversation in the very few days before the hurricane hits, when the hurricane watch comes out at about 48 hours before the winds start blowing. And they don't really have an aggregated, cohesive message. They put out these different advisories and maps and data, and it's up to TV meteorologists or radio meteorologists or people on the internet or who knows who to look in all that data and come up with a message. And so what the public gets is a bunch of opinions. Maybe they have somebody they trust on television. Maybe they don't. We just don't have those trusted figures at the level that we did, in decades past in the United States. Not to mention, people don't in general trust the media and the government anyway. These days is a huge problem.
Well, Brian, how do we change that?
Well, I think that the only entity that has general universal trust and people will listen to is the National Hurricane Center and the National Weather Service. Now, I'm not talking about 100%, but I'm talking about they have the ability to cut through the noise. And so I would prefer to see them have a higher profile. I'm not saying to the exclusion of anybody else. There's still a need for people to interpret the message and to localize the message and to talk about what it means for individuals in their homes and in their apartments. But I would like to see a regular update from the National Hurricane Center beginning when the storm becomes to be a top-of-mind threat. And so we know, so that we would know that at 8 o'clock in the morning and at 5 o'clock in the afternoon or whenever it was going to be, that there would be a briefing from the National Hurricane Center on what their thinking is of the storm, how confident they are in the forecast, what the issues are with on the technical level, and what their communication has been with emergency management and so forth. I think if they would get in that kind of rhythm, that would go a long way toward helping the public understand the sort of bottom line of where we are and put all of the other information they have in perspective. I don't see any other entity in our society that could do that in a hurricane threat except for the National Hurricane Center.
Now, Brian, I was in Broward County for Andrew. Remember your broadcasts. Even talking to you now, it mm-hmm. brings me back 25 years just hearing your voice. I mean, what do you want people to remember about your career? It's obvious that people in South Florida remember you for Andrew, but what do you want your legacy as a meteorologist, as a newscaster, to go down in history as?
Well, I want people to remember Andrew. I wrote a book, as you may know, that came out this year, and I can skip to the very end of the book and tell you what I think the number one lesson of Andrew is, and I hope when they think of me, they think of Andrew, and they think of the number one lesson, and that is that the worst does happen. We are so used to hurricanes that suddenly make a jog, and they're 50 miles away from the coast, and so it's nowhere near as bad as, you know, people said it could be. And there's a sense of, well, they always hype it. They always say it's going to be, you know, a bad storm. And it's, yeah, so we have some trees down and stuff like that, but it's not terribly bad. And Andrew proves that the worst does happen. Sometimes the storm is worse than you expect and worse than forecast. It's not always that it's, you know, it's something less. Now, most often it is something less because the forecasting process is telling you where what it's likely to be in kind of a worst reasonable case situation, which is not everywhere. The idea is we can't be precise, so we have to always alert more people than end up needing to be alerted in the end. It's always going to be that way. As long as we live, it's going to be that way. But people really do need, if they read my book or they study Hurricane Andrew, I hope they come away with the message of, you know, this is extremely serious business. I don't want to be caught in a situation like those folks in South Dade were caught in that didn't prepare for this extreme event to the level that they needed to. And, you know, we're going to take the steps and we're going to just make that part of living in Florida. Just like if we lived in Michigan, we'd be buying big, heavy winter coats and we have a really big furnace and lots of extra insulation in the house. You know, you do things based on where you live. And I just think in Florida, we don't take the hurricane threat here with the level of seriousness that it deserves. And the Hurricane Andrew proves that we should take it and make it part of our lives.
The book's called My Hurricane Andrew Story, The Story Behind the Preparation, the Terror, the Resilience, and the Renowned TV Coverage of the Great Hurricane of 1992. Brian Norquist was on television in Miami for 25 years, including during Hurricane Andrew. Now he joins the Weather Channel as Senior Hurricane Specialist back in 2010. Brian, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last August. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. If you missed an episode, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.